Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Graham suggested that we do a programme of a sort of lighter note of my own reminiscences of being somebody who taught at university. So I think I'm quite keen on that. I taught at two universities, Durham from 1980 to 1995, successively as lecturer, senior lecturer, reader and professor, and then moving to Exeter as the senior professor from 96 through till retiring in 2020. And I want to focus on Exeter because I wrote the institutional history, and that means I think I'm better qualified to talk about it. And indeed, I suspect, having been, as far as I could see, the only person to have read the archives since an earlier history was done at the beginning of the 80s, probably the only person who can fairly talk about it. But I'll make a few comments about Durham, if I might. When I went to Durham, the history department had an entry, I think, of 60 undergraduates a year. When I left, it was 150 a year. When I moved to Exeter, Exeter was 200 a year. And when I left Exeter, it was 400 a year. Now, what that necessarily meant is that however much you were committed to teaching, and I was committed to teaching, I enjoyed teaching, didn't enjoy marking, but I did enjoy teaching a lot. However much you were committed to teaching, it was in a different context when there were fewer people. I mean, bluntly, when you can remember everybody's names, it's much easier to interact with them as individuals than when you can't. And given that the latter is the present situation, we flip back to my comment I made earlier in this group of talks, that there is less value of going to a university if there isn't that personal connection. You might just as well do a lot of it other than the interaction with other students through a different process. Anyway, Durham gave considerable independence. I'd applied for the job under no illusion that I would get it. I was young. They interviewed six people, one of whom was already teaching in the place. And, you know, I was a postgraduate at Oxford. The usual rule at Oxford is however mediocre was somebody was, as long as, and same at Cambridge, as long as they'd got that institution marked on them, they were going to get it. And, you know, every single person who they interviewed was older than me. So the reason I applied was a simple one. I'd moved from St. John's in Oxford to Merton, and Merton looked after me very well. I had high table rights. I had free accommodation and food. But the one thing they didn't give me was a travel allowance. And I thought, gosh, I wanted to look at some early 18th century newspapers in Newcastle. I might just get interviewed at Durham. So don't worry, I could use that as an excuse. And that was exactly what I did. I went up the previous day, dined at very cautious expense at a Chinese restaurant, stayed the night because of the nature of the alphabet, was interviewed first. And by 10 o'clock, I was on a train en route from Durham to Newcastle, ensconced subsequently in the Central Library, reading hard copy newspapers from the early 18th century in the original, which was great. And then I'd arranged to stay the night with David Aldrich, who was an academic at Newcastle, and in his home in the Tyne Valley, him and his wife Josephine. So I arrived there by train, and David said to me, oh, he said, you know, somebody from Durham's been trying to ring you. And it turned out to be the then head of department who rang me up, told me that I'd got the job if I'd like it, and invited me to lunch the next day. So I turned up for lunch in University College, Castle. So it's really rather nice having lunch in a medieval castle. And Paul, who's still alive, I'm delighted to say, and with whom I have good relations, very nice man, great scholar. Paul had a terrible stutter, and I won't attempt to repeat that, but he sort of more or less managed to get out, what would I like to teach? and appeared quite incredulous when I told him, well, I'd teach what the job was advertised in. It seemed to me the obvious thing to do. I mean, whereas I have to tell you, people these days don't do that. I mean, Exeter hired a very famous academic as a junior lecturer, Alex Walsham, who's now the professor of modern history at Cambridge. And she was hired to teach 1250 to 1600 British history. And after a year, she announced she wasn't going to teach anything prior to 1500. I wouldn't have dreamt of doing that, different age, of course. So I was going to teach the early modern European, and I sought some guidance from Paul Harvey as to what he expected. And he said, well, it's up to you. It's your course. So, you'll have to do and add another course the following year and add another course the following year. Then you'll have three courses, and you can, the other two, please feel free to teach what you like. So that was, in fact, what I did at Durham. I taught a basic course, a good course, I have to say. I liked it. 1560 to 1730 European history. You might ask why it ended at 1730, and that was because John Rochester told me no way was I going to go into his territory, and as far as he was concerned, that started in 1730. I taught a second year course on Britain from 1688 to 1800, was able to persuade the archive section of the library to let me hold the course there so we could use and handle original pamphlets and other material from the period. And I taught a special subject on British foreign policy and politics in the age of Walpole. And I enjoyed it. It was good. I also enjoyed the early 80s. Both of the professors, Reg Ward, the modernist, and Paul Harvey, the medievalist, were good to me. And, I think I was a good colleague. Both of them went, Reg in the fullness of time. Paul had a row with some of his colleagues and departed. I think they came out of it, in my view, as small-minded individuals, but that's another matter. And we then got in a new professor, Anthony Fletcher, who was avant le temps, as it were. He would have gone in very well today, an expert on masculinity as a topic, wanted to change the syllabus. Anything from the past was clearly wrong. No sense of humor whatsoever. Reg Ward had used to, because his wife Barbara didn't like him cooking at home, he'd kept a baby Belling in the in one of his filing cabinets, and he used to cook for members of the department and himself. And I said to Anthony, well, a condition of the job is that you cook for the department. And you can imagine what he was like on that. Anyway, Fletcher didn't like me. I didn't like Fletcher. We had an uneasy period, but, I was writing a lot. I was teaching well. I was a admissions tutor. I was, being a good citizen as far as the university was concerned. So when Fletch tried to get rid of me, it didn't work and it boomeranged back on him. And, I got promoted up to professor. I think it's fair to say that, although that was very nice for me, being promoted over the heads of colleagues is not the easiest thing that can happen. And although I was, as it were, the second-ranking modernist, and Fletch disappeared very quickly, so I became, as it were, the senior one. It clearly that was odd. I was also virtually the youngest in the department because I'd been there quite a few years, but nobody had been hired between 1980 and 1992. And I sort of decided I didn't want to spend all my career in the same place. Sarah, my wife, took the view that, she hadn't much liked moving to go to the Northeast. She didn't want to move again. But if she was going to move, she had strong views on where to go. And when I was looking to move, unusually, there were four chairs up, which is very unusual over a 2-year period. One was Birmingham. She said, well, we live in Newcastle because that's where her job was. There's no reason to go to Birmingham, another big city. No. One was St Andrews. St Andrews, John Guy had rung me up and he said, you're on the shortlist for the chair. I told him I hadn't applied. He said, it doesn't matter. We're interviewing you. We'd like to give it to you. And Sarah said, we were already far enough north from Exeter, from London. We're not going any further north. There were two others then, Essex and Exeter. I rather liked Essex. East Essex is pleasant. It doesn't have the unattractive features of South Essex. And, you know, it would also have been relatively close to London from the archives. But Sarah sort of had the view that Essex was a terrible place, not that she'd ever been there. So it had to be Exeter. Well, it could have been Bristol, but I didn't imagine from her point of view. But Bill Doyle was not going to commit suicide for my benefit, no more than he should. So Exeter. So I applied for Exeter. Exeter did something that was quite unusual at that point. They actually had a chair appointment open to merit and talent. Again, this may sound a bizarre remark to make, but if you look, for example, at many of the senior appointments in the country, you will find that many of them are held from by people who are from within that institution. Now, you could pretend that they are the best person possible, but nobody in their right mind believes that. Anyway, Exeter had decided that they would only look at outsiders, and they looked at five people, four of whom already had chairs, and one of whom, very able man from Warwick, was soon to get one. You can never tell why you get appointed, and but anyway, I got the job. That meant that as the established chair, I was ex officio on Senate, and it was a good period again for me. The Vice Chancellor of the late 90s, Geoffrey Holland, got on with me. I got on with him. Whilst I didn't identify with all of his policies, and in particular was uneasy about, and understood why he was doing it, but was uneasy about the idea of a campus in Cornwall. Nevertheless, I could see a lot of what he was trying to do. He felt that the university was, as it were, behind the times, and he wanted to change things. And, you know, I also had a whole set of courses. I liked teaching. Exeter had a brilliant idea, which was that you taught different courses on odd and even years, which meant that the courses ran fuller because if you were a student and in the second year you didn't do that course, you wouldn't get a chance to do it again. So courses ran fuller, which is efficient. Staff didn't have to do the same course all the time, which is good for motivation. And you had to just work harder mugging up things, which I was fine with me. So I had a whole set of really interesting and exciting courses, and I liked the teaching, and I was quite motivated. I think it's fair to say my motivation changed in the late 2000s. The university became less flexible. They both at the level of the individual units within it and at the university as a whole. I found that courses I liked teaching were taken away and removed, and instead team teaching came in. This was supposedly more efficient. It wasn't, but anyway, that was there was a sort of move against lectures. I enjoyed lectures, so that was a problem. And the scale of steadily bigger departments, and I have to say, in the two teams, steadily more wokish approaches I didn't like. And a lot of them were small-minded. I mean, to give you an idea, I used to examine, it's an interesting aspect. Maybe we should do a program on this because examining is interesting. But I used to examine not just undergraduate, but also postgraduate things. So I would either be the internal examiner or the supervisor. And because I thought it was much more pleasant, because my house was within walking distance of the campus, I would hold the vivas in my house. I would always keep a bottle of sparkling in the fridge to bring out for the candidate when he or she passed. And I would always give all of this at my own expense, perfectly reasonably. I would always give the other examiner or two examiners lunch after the viva. Well, you can guess what happened. In the full pontifical cant of modern academe, the director of something or other, a role played by Jane Whittle, said that this was unreasonable because it was putting pressure on the examiners. I said, well, that's not putting pressure, it's just a courtesy. Anyway, that was ended. And my wife and I entertaining students in our home to tea. We'd always given my personal tutees cream teas on their divided them into two groups on the first two weekends of their first year. That was ended. And I just thought, oh, what a sort of grubby lot of mean-minded people who are so suspicious. I actually said, if you so dislike academics, why don't you just sack them? But this sort of thing went on, and so I continued teaching, and I was actually again, I was doing most of the first year teaching in the History of the World Part One and History of the World Part Two. But I have to say, my sort of inclination as far as the course structure was gone, decolonization, I thought was stupid. It is stupid, as well as being intellectually bogus. And in a sense, second-rate people were increasingly running the system. So I was happy to go in 2020. I was sorry to miss teaching. And I've welcomed the opportunity since to teach, but that was sorry to go. But the point of my remarks is not to talk about that. It's to talk about the fact that I wrote the institutional history, The City on the Hill, A Life of the University of Exeter, which was a big illustrated work, lots of text, about 150,000 words. It was subsequently slimmed down by me to a non-illustrated book of about 100 or maybe 90,000 words. So you can read one or the other. And what happened in this case is I was approached by the university. They had a significant anniversary coming up. So they asked their most senior historian if he would write the history of it. I was worried about what that would entail. So I said, well, there were two conditions. One, I would retain the copyright, not the institution, so that if they didn't like it, I could publish it elsewhere. And two, assuming they were going to want to publish it, as they did, it was my word as to what should be in it, not theirs. And to be fair, to be totally fair, they stuck to that. In fact, the Vice Chancellor, Sir Steve Smith, at the end, when he had read it, gave it back to me and he said, well, it's not what I would have said, but it's your book and you will publish it. Now, what was unusual about it, and there are other, it was nicely reviewed or mentioned by people. What was unusual about it is that it was both a history in which I used massive amounts of archival research. I mean, very easily to do so. The university was very generous in giving me time off. And of course, the archive was sitting there within walking distance. So that was great. And so I was able to read the archival material. But second of all, I also wrote to, I mean, the university also put a notice on the internet, but I wrote to absolutely every person I knew who'd been there or teaching in any capacity or an administrator or a student and asked them if they would send me their reminiscences, which I said I would subsequently deposit in the university archives, which I did. And on top of that, I interviewed as many people as I could. Well, the first two interviews told me what I already knew, that this was going to be an amusing but also difficult exercise because, you always want to interview the most prominent people first in case they, drop their clogs, as it were, die. So I thought, well, there are two previous vice chancellors extant, Sir David Harrison and Sir Geoffrey Holland. I will interview them. Well, you can guess what happened. Sir David, the interview was in was at the Athenaeum over lunch. Sir David told me that he'd passed on the university in an excellent stage, and with everything working properly, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Sir David had been vice chancellor from 1984 to 94. Sir Geoffrey, who came to my house for lunch, he came to my house on a number of occasions. He liked my cooking. Sir Geoffrey, who was vice chancellor from 1994 to 2002, said to me the university was in a dire state when he took over it, hopelessly out of date, on its way down, and desperately in need of salvation. Well, of course, this is what you expect. As a historian, and the sort of classic political approach, which is you go somewhere down the middle, or you throw yourself heartily and fully into one camp or other, was not really what I was interested in, because I wanted to be guided by the archives, guided by my perceptions. And also historians, the difference between academic historians and people who call themselves historians, like this rather mediocre person I reviewed recently, I think Sangara is his name, in The Critic, who wrote a book on decolonization. The difference between a proper historian is they do source criticism. They understand why sources push in different directions and how you drill down through them to try and work out what really happened and why it happened, whilst also trying to work out why people had different accounts of it. The last is often the easiest. The former part can be considerably difficult. Now, in trying to assess the university during this period, there were the problems of the sources, there were the problems of the interpretation of the sources in specific terms, and there were the problems of what kind of long-term narrative and analysis I wish to offer, and also how much weight to place on exogenous factors, in other words, the external world, whether it's inflation in the early 70s or the period of change under Mrs. Thatcher, how much exogenous or social changes in the late 60s, and how much you want to do it to internal factors. So all of those were issues, and I think it's fair to say that for me, the most interesting in many respects, but then I'm a sad character, was reading the sources. Until there was a change of registrar in the beginning of the 90s, who very much favoured a more abbreviated style of taking notes at senior committees, until then, the practice was to actually note different viewpoints and to offer a fuller account. The other point was the university was almost over-administered in its early decades as an independent institution. And what that meant is you get a mass of documentation, not so much a physical mass, though of course you do get a physical mass, but the scholar's got to be interested in more things like that. What you get is a mass in the sense that one committee is trying to persuade another committee, a third committee is reporting to a fourth committee, and you've got, as a result, an enormous amount of material. And I think that is... You know, I'm going to read some passages from interviews because they tend to be the most witty things, and that's often what people want to listen to. I mean, you know, look at the trivia that passes for most podcasts. But I think if you want to think of this as a serious scholar, the other point to make is that in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, I think it was the case that people didn't assume these archives would necessarily ever be read again. And that, I think, led to a certain freedom of writing. There was, of course, the episode during the period of Harry Kay as Vice-Chancellor. Harry Kay was Vice-Chancellor from 1973 to 1984. And during his period in time, there was a breakdown in relations between, shall we say, certainly the Vice-Chancellor himself and some of the more radical students and staff. And what that led it to was a sit-in, break-in, I think one could fairly say, at the university offices. And what then happened was the documents that he had been keeping, allegedly on members of staff, well, certainly on members of staff, were revealed. And that actually was an episode, quite a funny episode, but not very funny for those involved, which did show, the danger of keeping archives. I mean, what had happened is he had issued a statement endorsed by Senate that no secret files containing information about, I'm reading here, the political or religious opinions or affiliations of students and other members of the university are kept by the University of Exeter. Well, when there was the break-in, It was revealed that he'd been lying, that he kept what was known as the list, and the list was of people who were, in his eyes, a nuisance, in fact, there were three lists, and I write about it in the thing, and if you want to find about it, you know, one of the lists was concerned the financial situation of particular professors, the other, another, their sexual activity, and so on and so forth. Other than that, the assumption was that documents would be kept secret. And this assumption meant that there was a freedom of writing, which I think it's fair to say we have now lost. Now, I promised I would give some quotations from individual things. I'm going to move between students and staff and to give an idea of the flavor of, well, the vast amount of stuff you get. I mean, I heard all about everything from shooting rabbits on the university grounds and the university had to work out, this was a marvelous one in the late 50s, how to deal with the rabbits, which members of shock staff were going to be allowed to shoot on the grounds, and what was to be done to make sure that not too many students or fellow staff got killed. But there was, you know, all sorts of things. There was the most spectacular legal case, which was the case of, he's dead now, Roy Porter, not the famous historian Roy Porter, who was a very nice man, but a theologian called Roy Porter, head of the theology department. He wasn't a very nice man. I myself met him once at lunch at Christchurch. He was a very unpleasant man. Anyway, Porter, how should one put this? Police were rung up one evening to be told that Professor Porter had been assaulted. This was a friend of Porter's in the sociology department was ringing up. The Porter had been assaulted and robbed, and, you know, they must, you know, go around and do something about it. So the police went round, they took a statement from the Reverend Canon. I mean, he was a canon of Salisbury Cathedral, as well as obviously being a clergyman. The Reverend Canon to about all of this, the Reverend Canon said that somebody had broken in and tried to steal something, had stolen something, and had punched him in the face when he tried to resist. So the police rapidly, on the basis of the identification, were able to arrest this person. Case went to trial. The prosecution was according to what I've just said. The defence offered a very different account, that the Reverend Canon Professor had solicited this young man. They'd gone back to his residence. They'd had sex. The young man had then asked for payment. Porter had laughed at him, whereupon he'd been clouted. What was interesting about the case was not so much that. I mean, you know, different people will offer different accounts of things. It was that the judge directed the jury that in his view, they couldn't trust the testimony of the Reverend Canon Professor. Despite that, he wasn't sacked. Anyway, so it's not so much those kind of cases, though it is extraordinarily what you can find out if you go through the archives of an institution. But it's more the, you know, the more whimsical and also reflective. So this comes from a chap called Robert Escott, who did a finance MA in 1972 to 1973. I met my future wife on the boat from Cape Town to Southampton. To help pay for myself, I acted as an agent for someone in South Africa and bought for them a Porsche. At that time, you couldn't buy luxury cars in South Africa, but I could, and then bring one back. I had to run up some mileage, so did from time to time drive it to campus. In those days, not many people had cars on campus, most certainly not Porsches. I used to get notes inviting me to tea or pubs, etc., to meet the scribe. I loyally turned these down until one day I noticed an attractive girl tucking it under the wiper, and I decided I would follow up. That night, my future wife's roommate in London told her that her sister in Exeter University had met this fabulous guy from South Africa with a Porsche. My wife was on the next train down from Paddington, and my social life was very clipped after that. Or take something different here. This is Peter Dewey's account of being taught in 1964 to 5 in what in effect was a combined social sciences. He was a student in economic history. He went on to become an academic. The head of the Department of Government, H. Victor Wiseman. His lecturing style was impressive. A short, solid man, looking a bit like Napoleon Bonaparte, begowned for his lectures. He usually entered at speed, puffing his pipe, and spoke rapidly. The impression was of a stock of enormous and important knowledge imparted to us as equals. Quite intoxicating. The only other politics lecturer who equaled him in student popularity was Dr. Dowes, who impressed in what was really a rather showy way, dressed in expensive leather jackets and used slang to titillate the oh-so-conventionally middle-class audience. Or Richard Langhorne, another academic later, recalls the women's halls, particularly one called Thomas, were run by dragonesses who liked to guard the social niceties of their charges and was very much concerned with how to behave at dinner, as well as not entertaining gentlemen in their rooms. One more distant men's hall, that was Crossmead, had a liberal-minded sociologist as warden, that was Richard Lynn, who had to resign after it was discovered that the loos had become blocked by used contraceptives. Arriving to teach history, Bruce Coleman, who was to go on to be a deputy vice chancellor from 1989 to 93, and who I'm glad to say is still alive, noted a sort of mixture of conservatism and innovation. Exeter struck me as small, provincial, inward-looking, and often idiosyncratic. Here was a sense of limited horizons and even of self-satisfaction. The proposal under consideration in 1970 to 71 was to increase student numbers from 3,750 to 4,100. It was met with much doom-mongering, and members of staff fancied that it would lead to the end of the society of the university. Another aspect that struck me, particularly after Cambridge, was the high proportion of female students. That was a point noted by many contemporaries, and indeed goes on to be the case, that Exeter was always seen as a good university for girls, quote, safe environment, etc., served it well over decades in which female participation in HE rose faster than male participation. But he then noted, and of course this was true of so many commentators, that things that might sound quaint, there are also, drill down, you'll find, press on, interesting things. So he noted, academically, Exeter was quite interesting, even innovative. Those single honours degrees recruited the bulk of students. Exeter had the widest range in the country of combined honours programmes. There are also the kind of documents that you have to wonder what on earth is going on that people can decide to waste so much time. So this is the Board of Senate on the 5th of March, 1980. The Vice-Chancellor reminded the Board that the Standing Committee had recommended in the Michaelmas term that no change in the present procedure, he's talking about the election of deans, be made, but this had not been accepted. The matter had been referred to the faculty boards, and it was noted that four recommended no change, whilst the remaining two were each putting forward a different proposal. A visitor from another culture at that point might have wondered what the purpose of the university was, and in fact quite a lot of the documents were like that. Other sources could be hilarious. I went all the way through the university newspapers. The one that was most prominent was one called Expose. So this is Expose from the 21st of June, 1993. Top tip, to save washing garments and money, why don't the majority of males at the main site simply paint their upper torsos in apricot white with a V-shaped cutaway underneath the neck? Then simply add coloured lines, the choice is yours, around this section and along the cuffs. Hey presto, you've created one of those bloody awful cricket sweaters that seem to be the mandatory form of attire these days. Expose was often, that was a kind piece from Expose. Expose was often particularly blunt and brutal about the nature of student life, but also it could be blunt and brutal about some aspects of what the university staff were getting up to or not getting up to. So I've given you a sort of flavour of some of the material you can find in the archives. The question was at every stage, what to make of it? Well, first of all, most of the people interviewed had absolutely no idea whatsoever about the finances of the institution. And of course, if one is reading the archives, that is what is most prominent. The nature of the fiscal exigencies, the desperate attempts to find ways to use the modern phrase, these days they call it grow revenues, let's just say increase revenues. And that was not easy to find. I mean, if you want to contrast, you will find if you want to contrast, you want to actually take the Daily Mail, because the Daily Mail was able to comment on in 2012. About an episode, no, 2013, January 2013, when a couple got rather carried away at a university student ball. The university had a sex ball called, not for the purpose of sex, for the purpose of providing money for a charity to support AIDS. It was called the Safer Sex Ball. The Daily Mail suggested that the ball was a reminder of the decadence that came just before the end of the fall of the Roman Empire, which was, I think, an interesting vignette. I wasn't aware that they had were well up on the scholarship of people like Brian Ward Perkins or Peter Heather. But anyway, on the whole, it's money that predominated. The university never had much money. And that caused it problems all the way through and led it often into initiatives like developing an overlarge school of education in the 80s and 90s, essentially because there was money that way. And I think it's fair to say it's still very much in that position. I served a period on the university's finance committee as well as on council, the governing body. And I think it's fair to say that what always struck me as completely stupid listening to many of my teaching colleagues is they seemed to imagine that there was the equivalent of, to use more a subsequent term, a magic money tree, when in fact for quite a long period the university was desperately concerned about whether its bankers, Barclays, would continue to, you know, allow it to finance its debt, and how it would cope, etc., etc. So I found it fascinating. I think linking up to the previous discussions that we've had, I think the financial key is important. The obligation on council, statutory obligation on council, is to not allow the institution to go bust. And I think there was a, to my mind, as and the same thing was true of the country as a whole, so this is not a specific criticism of universities, but to my mind, there was in the two teens and in the early 220s, as part of parallel to the quantitative easing, which in the case of universities meant borrowing money at low rates of interest, a spending of money on what I would regard as foolish purposes. I think the enormous expansion of HR and in particular inclusion and diversity courses has not contributed to the university one little bit. And I think it's almost as if we've gone in cycles during the, if you look at the papers, the archival material for the 1960s, there was an exuberance to expand in the late 60s, early 70s, you know, to go along to the relevant government committee, please, sir, we'd like this, please, sir, we'd like that. And the university ended up with departments like chemical engineering it simply couldn't sustain. And I think that in a way the same has happened again. I suspect that we are going to see a process of consolidation in courses in universities. Exeter's got a good name, it gets good undergraduates, it's got some good departments. The leadership over, in my view, in the last few years in the has been poor, very poor, I would say. But it should be possible for it to to focus on its strengths and to recruit accordingly. And if I might broaden that out, I think that I would not be sanguine about very many universities, which means I think politics is going to be much more significant. And I'll end on a comment made to me by a German academic, a very distinguished German academic, Harold Kleinschmidt. He and I were having dinner some years ago here. He's coming to visit me. You know, he remarked about the fact that you needed to be linked to the political party that ran the Land that you were in, the province you were in a German university. So, you know, if it was, if you were in Bavaria, it'd be the CSU, it'd be Baden-Württemberg, the CDU, North Rhine-Westphalia, and the SPD, and so on. And I said, that seemed to me very odd. I said, you know, there's no pressure on me accordingly. I said, you know, I'm a conservative. We've got a Labour government in, this is the government of Tony Blair. I said, you know, don't feel that this means that I can't do my job. And he said, well, you're foolish. He said, clearly it's very important in Germany that the senior academics are members of the same party branch as the administrators, the civil servants in the Land, because that's how you get benefits for your department. So that left me somewhat thoughtful. But let me end on an amusing note. Many years ago, in the early 80s, I was working in the Archives Nationales in Paris, and I fell into conversation with a chap who was teaching at an Italian university. It shall remain nameless, but I've made inquiries subsequently, and it does seem that what he was saying was true. And I asked him, you know, what his job entailed. He was the head of the department. And he said, well, he never had to teach undergraduates. He said his job was really a matter of keeping the department in line. And I said, well, what does that mean? And he said, well, you know, we're a Christian Democrat university. You know, I'm supposed to see that it stays in line. And I said, well, what happens if you're a communist in the staff? He said, oh, you can go and get a job in Bologna. I said, well, what else do you have to do? And he said, well, once a week I go down to Rome to the ministry on behalf of the university, and I sit in waiting rooms and eventually get to see the senior, relevant senior civil servants. And, you know, I sort of make representations and say the right things. And then once every 2 months, we have the key fellow come up and visit us. We put him up in the best hotel in the city, and we get him the services of the best whore we can. And I just thought to myself, yes, well, it is a slightly different world, isn't it? But I can't help but wondering in Britain, when you're going to have a lot of universities, I think we have something like 159 plus, many of which really clearly aren't fit for purpose, but with many people in them who are going to be keen to preserve their perks and jobs. And you're obviously going to get these devolved assemblies and governments, such as the one that's just crashed in Scotland, where, shall we say, systems of public probity are not always maybe what they should be. And I wonder whether we are increasingly going to have an Italianate system of governance. Thank you very much, Graham.
Well, Professor Jeremy Black, thank you very much. I'm afraid we're out of time, so I won't have the opportunity to ask you more questions, but I do have the chance to thank you for a marvellous tour partly autobiographical tour, and also calling upon your knowledge as the historian of Exeter University. Parts of your anecdotes there read as if it was from a Tom Sharp novel.
Oh, you should read A City on... It's very difficult to get hold of copies of it, but it's a lot of it is like a Tom Sharp. And I can tell you, it's fascinating. By the way, if you want another programme on this, we could do one which I think would very much interest listeners on what the nature of examining is and the processes involved and what you look for if you're examining history essays or indeed history PhDs.
The next episode will be on examining. I think that's a great subject. Jeremy, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.